What I'm talking about in corporate bigamy is not a fellow who has two jobs, but rather a man or a woman who has the problem of balancing the pressures of life, the pressures of the job situation as well as the family situation. And these pressures, I think, are draining the vital forces that bind marriages together. I believe it is possible to develop what we refer to in psychoanalytic terms or psychological terms as a homeostasis. I think it is possible to balance these two forces so that the families can retain their integrity and that we can raise healthy and productive children. But it's going to be a job because, unfortunately, the pressures of the job situation have become a time bomb at the family fireside. And I'm going to outline the challenges and the problems. I want to point out that what I'm talking about is not just referring to men, because women are now becoming a vital part of this whole problem and challenge. Many women are going back to work and are having the same kind of problems of being drained by their jobs and not having sufficient energy or time to maintain the marital relationship.
Oh, there you are. I'm waiting and waiting, and you didn't even phone. Oh,
but you know I'm still breaking in this new assistant. Oh, he's a bright fellow, but inexperienced. He's got a lot to learn about the business.
But it's the third time this week. Don't I and the kids rate some attention, too?
Well, of course, dear, but you know what happens when you get a promotion. It did mean a lot to me. And it does help the family. Why else am I doing it?
Well, anyway, it's Friday. We've got the weekend.
Oh, did you forget? I'm leaving Sunday afternoon for that pre-convention meeting with the regional people in San Francisco. Well, I told you that weeks ago.
Blast that company. What's the use? Let's have a drink.
So you see, as women more and more move into the managerial ranks, the problem of corporate bigamy increasingly goes both ways. Really, the dramatic incentive for this cassette series came from a man who wrote to me because I had written an article for the Ladies' Home Journal. This man wrote from New Zealand. So you can see this is not just an American or a United States problem.
Dear Dr. Feinberg, I was interested to read your recent article in the Ladies' Home Journal. Having had the article pointed out to me, you could say I fall roughly into the category of young businessman depicted. Your 10 suggestions are good enough to keep for reference and reminder from time to time. I'd be most interested to see you now round off the other half of the problem, a picture. How the young wives of these young men, who want to achieve something more than some others and are prepared to undergo the rigors of business to do so, can become an effective member of the family team, achieving mutual goals, providing the many things for a family that business can never provide. My inquiry is genuine. Your experience can be of help to women as well as men. So many women feel they have to compete with business rather than offset it in such a way that the family and business demands fall into their true and proper perspective for both wife and husband. At 34, in the top executive position of a company employing nearly 600 people, I'm interested in both sides of this problem, not only for myself, but also for others. Yours sincerely.
And then he signs his name. So I guess really this cassette is dedicated to this young executive from New Zealand who stimulated me to write and lecture and prepare material further to balance out both sides of the picture. To understand marriage, one has to understand the nature of change. We are living in a world in which the human mind is being put under intolerable pressure because of the nature of the volatile changes that our culture is going through. I'd like to review some of these factors, and I've listed 9 of them, not 10. When I was a young psychologist, I used to run around the country giving a lecture called A Decalogue for Child-Rearing Practices, the 10 Commandments for Child-Rearing Practices. I got married, I changed that lecture to 10 guides for child-rearing practices. With the advent of my first son, I changed that lecture to 10 hints for child-rearing practices. With the advent of my second son, I will never give a lecture entitled The Decalogue. So therefore, everything I do now is limited to 9 rather than to 10. First, instant gratification, which is affecting marriages as well as the economy. People are anxious to avoid what I call sweating the smallies of life. They want to have everything done conveniently, and they want to have it so that it is in every area of their life. You know, have it now, enjoy it now. The second part of this is the whole factor of convenience foods. Mothers don't want to chop and peel and clean. They want to be much like a mother whale. You know the way a mother whale feeds its young? It feeds it once a week, the belly swells, and you get the little kid out the back door so that you can go out to fulfill yourself. Third factor is you want to have fun and color in your life. You want all the products of your life to have some fun and some color. You know, it's even supposed to be fun to blow your nose. You're supposed to have different colored toilet paper to go with the internal decor of the bathroom. Everything's supposed to be fun in color. In addition, of course, we have different kind of pleasures that we seek in this particular age. Now, as you know, the drug of choice of my generation is alcohol. The drug of choice of my son's generation is marijuana. You know, most of these kids do, as you know, most of you know, and if you don't know that, you're like Lady Godiva's husband who grabbed her and said, "Where have you been? The horse has been back for an hour and a half." Now, I asked my son the other day, who's a medical student, and I said to him, "What do you think your son will be hooked on? Mime on alcohol, your generation on pot. What do you think your son will be on?" He says, "Well, I think I'll come home at night and my son will be hooked into the electrical circuitry. And he'll be having electrical stimulation through his rectum." And he said, "You ought to try this, Dad." And you know, there is some reality to this in the sense that we do know that there are approximately 15 pleasure centers in the brain. And you can stimulate them electrically. You can just see people 5 years down the pike, which is really within the realm of possibility, hooked into an electrical wiring board having buttons on it. One person might stop another, and they might hold a conversation like this.
"How do you get so zonked?"
"It's a gas. Try it. 2 and 7.
Sexy?
You gotta believe it.
Oh, but I'm only wired for 6 buttons.
"Oh, a virgin. Don't feel too bad. Why don't you try a triple? 3, 5, and 6.
That a good trip?"
"Far out.
Kind of lonely doing it yourself. Oh, well, here goes."
Although, I think there's something immoral in playing your own chess console. I think it should be 2 consenting adults playing each other's console. Then, of course, we have the area of sexual repression and sexual possibilities. We are living in an era where all of the sexual possibilities are suddenly upon us. We are adrift in a sea of sexual possibilities. We're a swim in an unending erotic sizzle. You know, my generation was raised under the sexual repression that people like Sigmund Freud and Bertrand Russell once worried about. Now it threatens to smash through the cabinet of the clocks. The pendulum has swung so far from sexual repression to sexual freedom. Next, we have probably one of the most important changes, and that is the women's liberation movement. It has lifted women's anticipations. Women are no longer content to to be at home, to follow the traditional roles. They want to have careers. They want to be self-fulfilled. They want to make certain that they make a contribution and that they do not just live in the shadow of their successful husband. Now, all of this has resulted in the seventh point, which is the defunctionalization of the wife's role. She has really no place. With instant gratification, convenience foods, fun and color, electrical stimulation, sexual possibilities, women's lib movement, the women's traditional role has been eroded. She has become, which is my eighth point, the de facto wife. Like the Japanese experience has indicated, the Japanese have the wife at home, but they have geisha girls who kind of fan them and soothe them at the end of the day, and then they go home to their wife, and it's a traditional role. Well, we have not that kind of institutionalization of different kind of roles. It has all been blurred. We have a loss of the wife's credentials. Because of her education, she has built up anticipations, expectations, which lead to conflict. And ninth, of course, in the area of change has been attitudes towards work. This has changed. People no longer see necessarily their whole fulfillment in their work. This has been a change which has occurred only, I would estimate, in the last 8 to 10 years. Now, these are the changes I see. Some are lasting and some are transitory. And that is a question that perplexed the mind. Which of these are permanent and which of them are just part of the last decade of our lives? Which of these things are an episode and which are an epoch? It is hard for me to tell, but I want to outline them because they are influencing and will in the near future influence the whole area of marriage. I think we have to understand for absolute certainty that the future is not what it used to be. Whether these changes are transitory or whether they are an epoch, we will find out, but we will know that the future is not what we have anticipated in the past. Now, while all these macro changes are going on, there are also micro changes going on in the individual marriage. Years ago, I used to teach an elementary psychology course at the Baruch College of the City University. And I used to use an expression, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Now, I just want you to know that I know the technical words as well. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is an old biological concept which says that the life of the individual goes through the same stages as the life of the species. So that the embryo has a gills and has a tail and goes through the same kind of species development. So that what I am saying is that these great changes that are going on in the culture are simultaneously going on in the development of the individual marriage. The individual marriage has 8 stages that it goes through. It's like an embryo goes through the species development, so the marriage goes through stages, and it goes through your marriage and mine. And I guess they're very similar to the 7 stages of Shakespeare's man. The first stage is what I call the beginning stages, and these are buttressed by the work of Rollins and Feldman, who have done a marvelous job, and I will comment on their work. They talked about these stages. Stage 1 is the beginning family. The couples are married. It's 0 to 5 years. There are no children. It's an easy time. It's the honeymoon stage. As some person once observed in marriage, that marriage is the only meal where the dessert comes first. So some people find that this is the best stage of life. Stage 2 is a childbearing stage, where the oldest child is anywhere from 0 to 2 years and 11 months old. Stage three is where the families have preschool children. The oldest child somewhere between 3 and 5 years old. Stage four is the family and school-age children. The oldest child 6 years to 12 years, 11 months old, approximately. Stage five is families with teenagers. The oldest child 13 years to 20 years. Stage six is families as a launching center. Just like the arrow leaves the bow, the child leaves the home. Now, somebody said the best part of Christmas is seeing the lights on the departing cars of their young college students. Stage seven is the families in the middle years, the empty nest to retirement. Stage eight is the aging families, retirement to the death of the first spouse. Now, the most difficult stage for the traditional marriage is the woman who is in between stages two and five. And the double whammy is that it is also the most difficult stage for the man. Now, she's locked in. The kids are bothering her. She has to watch nonsense television programs. And the outside world is telling her, kid, have fun, have instant gratification. You're a swim in a sea of sexual possibilities. You've got a long way, baby. And as she's locked in with the children, with the pressures of the home, and she's told she should be doing much more than that.
Fulfill yourself. Make a career for yourself.
And cook three meals a day and clean the house? Thanks a lot.
Everybody plays around a little. An attractive woman like you? What's the harm? Loosen up.
With three young kids in the house?
You've got lots of opportunities. After all, with your husband working late all those evenings.
And with a dozen neighbors looking in the picture window. Anyway, it's just not my style.
You ought to get out more. Have fun, fun, fun.
What fun? Alone? What kind of fun with my husband away on business trips? He's having the fun.
While at the same time, her husband is locked into his career possibilities. While he's doing his thing, which, by the way, he has to do in order to bring the bread to the table. So they are both kind of locked in those stages two to five. He's doing his thing. He is positioning himself so that he can enjoy with her the empty nest period. And so the marriage is most vulnerable in that second to fifth phase. To dramatize and illustrate what it's like, we have to understand the people I am referring to. What does an educated woman, who is now a mother with young children, she graduated, say, in 1968, so she would have children in that earlier stage. I want to find out what she's like. It would dominate her thinking. In order to better understand this generation, I pulled out this commencement prayer given by Susanna Wood when she graduated from Radcliffe.
We pray that you will hear us as we think about our graduation, even though we have trouble using the traditional language for talking to you, and though many of us no longer feel a part of a religious community. Graduation presses the past and the future together in our minds so that we face it with mixed feelings and we do not know what to affirm. It is especially hard for us because the events of this year have forced us to have a personal reaction to public events. We do not feel like a cool, swinging generation. Somehow, this year, more than others, we have had to draw lines, to try to find an absolute right with which we could identify ourselves. There is a strain in all we do, a sense of the time is now, added to what we would feel anyway as we graduate. We are grateful for what we have learned and experienced here, but we are not sure we have done the best we could. We feel we have gained a certain competence, but realize we fall far short of what we would do or be. We pray that you will help us accept the past and face the future with courage and dignity. Help us to leave our friends with love that does not depend on geography. Help us to prepare a kind of renaissance in our public and private lives. Let there be born in us a strange joy that will help us to live and to die and to remake the soul of our time.
Now, man, that trumpet call from a young mother, whether she is or not, she typifies her generation. It is a clear clarion call. Now we then see the dimensions of our problem. How can we protect ourselves as the wife goes through her difficulties? The husband is on the way up in those stages 2 to 5. A man has to answer some of the questions that are given to him, and he has to be able to respond to some degree to the kind of defenses that we all develop when we're in crisis. She's coming up with her ways to defend herself against the challenges of those stages, and the husband is coming up with his ways, too.
But the children never see you anymore. They're in bed by the time you get home, and the weekend you spend on those papers...
But that's the whole point, don't you see? I'm doing it all for the kids. College is big money, and besides, we want to be comfortable and enjoy things.
Enjoy things? I want to enjoy you.
But I'm doing it for you, too. And it isn't all that bad. After all, you've got a nice home. You can go shopping when you want. We've got nice friends. We take vacations. Julie's taking piano lessons.
And I practically have to make an appointment to see you.
Well, if you took some interest in my career and my plans for the future...
Your plans? Why not our plans? Well, why not let me in on what's happening? Maybe I could share some of your work life if you talked about it more with me and we could...
How can I do that when the first thing I enter the door, it's do this and do that, fix the window, cut the grass, go pick up Andy. Here, I'm just a hired hand. In the office, I'm somebody.
Well, I'm somebody, too. Or doesn't a degree from Wisconsin mean anything?
Here we go round again. I try to reason with you, and all we get is the same old argument. What's for dinner?
Let's look at some of the alibis that the husband comes up with during the stage of 2 to 5 when they're having all these crises. He said, kid, I'm really doing this only for you and the kids. This is absolutely patent nonsense. This man we've described wouldn't have any other life. He thrives on strong hours. I'm going to describe that later. Most successful men that these women marry like to work. They pick this kind of life because it serves an inner need. Second alibi the husband comes up with, you have everything you possibly want. Money, social status, a beautiful home. What could you possibly complain about? When executive gives material possessions to a neglected wife, he's going to try to ease his own conscience. I say, who drew up the list? What is it that she wants, or is it things that you decided she wants? You aren't interested in my career. Now, this is one of the favorite excuses. No wife can be interested in something she knows nothing about. Do you really try to include her in discussions affecting the family? Do you draw her into the business circle? Do you share the experience with her? Do you discuss the parts of your work that might excite you and also might excite her? Or do you just grumble over your disappointments, frustrations, and problems? This, by the way, is one of the reasons why many young men may be turned off business. All they heard about from their father was the grumbling. Alibi 4, you don't recognize me for what I am. I'm a big man. You know, 200 years ago, I could develop a little skit and go back with me in your mind. 200 years ago, Martha Washington, with a brave smile, turned to a husband and said, George, before you leave to take the command of the Continental Army, to free us from the yoke of tyranny, to write a new page in the history of mankind. Before you do all that, would you do a favor for me, George? The future father of our country answered in his deep and stately voice. And what is that, Martha? She said, take out the garbage. That's the way it was in 1775. No, I guess that's the way it is today. Typically, you come home from a hard day, your wife says, fix the leak, change the faucet, the grass needs cutting. Your wife is trying to turn you into a handyman, said many executives. Unfortunately, she's got no executive titles to turn around to give you, so she's just trying to get you actively involved in managing your house as you are managing your business. Chances are she'd prefer a genuine lover to a handyman, but she can't ask for that directly. I'm a very busy man. I don't have time for the family. I can't reason with you anymore. Every time I try to talk to you, you turn this discussion into a terrible argument. This is probably a legitimate excuse, and for many men it is the only excuse for not being able to work out personal problems with their wives. Yes, you could stay unmarried as an executive. You could be the swinging type. Unfortunately, most of the counselors in the college campuses and later on the psychoanalysts find that the swingers are not happy. The least happy people in our culture are divorced people, separated people. You have to understand that there are many ways in which a society goes to ruin. And some of the ways are not paying enough attention to this whole concept of the nuclear family. Corporations cannot ignore this problem. Human mental health is involved, as I started at the beginning. In terms of the sweep of our times, this time, in the words of Charles Dickens, describing the period just before the French Revolution.
It is the best of times, and it is the worst of times. It is the season of light, it is the season of darkness. It is the spring of our hope, it is the winter of our despair. We are all going straight to heaven, we are all going straight the other way.
I would like to point us, humbly but hopefully, in the direction of making it the best of times rather than the worst of times. And one way to begin is by examining the problems of marriage. There's a harried manager. His wife has exceeded the budget for 3 weeks going. She has tickets for the theater, but she picked the wrong night. Dinner is late, and when she finally serves it, the roast chicken is burned to a crisp. He's had two martinis, and they're at each other.
If you worked for me, I'd fire you.
Well, if I were working for you, I would have quit a long time ago.
Burnt chicken.
No, dear. Just well done.
Well, I guess that's really where we are now. How can we get both of them to reflect? How can we get her to stop quitting and him to stop getting so exacerbated? There's a real problem here. Let me reflect on my years of experience on the different types of executives, managers, doctors, lawyers, generals of the army that I have known. Somebody once referred to my listing as the Chamber of Horrors. So let's look like we're in a wax museum, and I will point to the exhibits and try to describe them. There are four exhibits in this chamber that I'd like to draw your attention to. There's the monster type, the Janus type, the neat achievement type, and the Abraham type. Let me first start with the monster type. He's a monk of industry. He's the universal father. He's a father to everybody except his own family. As one person observed, an eagle makes a very poor household pet. We have the Janus type, like the mythology. He's looking both ways. He wants to be a great father, a great executive, a great husband, a great lover, a great entrepreneur. Somebody once said, the Janus type is basically a monster who thinks he's a good salesman, that he can sell his family on the fact that he should put all of his commitment into the job situation rather than the family. The third is the need achievement type. He's a balanced executive. He's financially acquisitive. He's competitive. He's male heterosexual. And he wants a good family. Fourth is the Abraham type. I guess he's the male counterpart in the Bible of the Virgin Mary. He's the universal father who sees himself as devoting himself exclusively to his family. Now, I realize those of you who are biblical scholars would tell me that Abraham wanted to sacrifice Isaac, but he did not want to. He came up to that mountain trembling, but God wanted to see how far he could test him. But Abraham's commitment was to Isaac and to his family. So we have these types, the monster, the Janus, the need achievement, the Abraham. Let's paint a picture in words of the monster type. This type, by the way, is not a monster. I have labeled him so because he's a monster in marriage. But he's not a Frankenstein. He's a productive person. He's a maker of kingdoms. He's a president of a country. He's the man who will develop the new vaccine to conquer cancer. Let me point out that this person that I am describing, this monster type, is not just in the industrial field. He's also in the political field, in the artistic field, in the military field, in the medical field. The effect on the children of these monsters is appalling. Their marriages are disasters. But they are the captains of industry. They are the great playwrights. They are the great politicians. Unfortunately, it takes a heavy toll. As one executive described it to me,
my family suffers the most. I suffer from fatigue, but they suffer from loneliness.
I think I have painted a picture of the monster, or rather history, and these quotes have painted the picture. And again, I want to point out that these are men who are marvelous to be friends of, but not to be married to. Because everything comes before their family. Now let's look at the Janus type. He's brilliant. He's got an instinct for the jugular. He's a monster who thinks he's a super salesman. He thinks he can sell his wife anything. And his children anything. This instinct for the jugular is something that overpowers them even when they deal with their families. They're always critical about everything. That's why it's part of their strength, but it's also part of their weakness in the family situation. Now, one such Janus type, on their 30th anniversary, his wife said to him, "Today, dear, I'm going to do anything you want me to do. Anything." So he looked at her and said, "For breakfast, boil me one egg and fry me one egg." She obediently presented it to him. He looked at it in an angry way and she said, "Dear, what is the matter? I did what you requested." He said, "Stupid, you boiled the wrong egg." So whether they are right or wrong in their instinct for the jugular, they are always habit. They're tough. They're demanding. They're ambivalently torn. They'd like to do everything. Result of that, whenever you have ambivalence, you also have a lot of guilt. See, the monster type has very little guilt. The Janus type has guilt. The third is the need achievement type. I borrowed that term from the work of Professor McClellan. He's a financially acquisitive. He wants to achieve. Male, usually. We're talking now about the males. He's heterosexual. He pays close attention to the details of his working life. However, he says my family is more important, and my theme song will be that I will defer success. Defer it until the children are older. The monster says success comes first. The Janus type says, let's tango, let's do both. I'll be able to balance them both. I'll carry both on my shoulders. The neat achievement type says, I will defer success temporarily because my family is more important than my economic success. But I want the economic success. I need it to feel self-fulfilled, but I will on at times exchange part of that success for the family's success. Finally, we have the family father, the Teviers of the world, like in Fiddler on the Roof. What was the great appeal of Fiddler? Why did everybody produce it and was translated into more languages and had the greatest success on Broadway? Because the Tevier described in that character a father who said, my family is more important than anything else, and he was worried constantly about his daughters and how they were going to get married, and he was trying to balance their pressures against change. You know, he was a man caught in a world of change. Remember the way he would describe it? He said, on the one hand, she loves the butcher. On the other hand, she should do what I tell her to do. She should marry the man picked out by the matchmaker. On the other hand, there is love in her eyes. Everything in his life revolved around his children. My father was similar to that. He cared little about what the world thought. He cared only about what his family thought. Now, these are the types. How can we talk to them? How can I make them listen? Guess the best way to start is to first ask the question, what goes wrong in a marriage? You know, what are the signs when it starts to fall apart? And here I turn to the work of Krupinski, Marshall, and Ewell, who analyzed the problems of 641 marriages, and these were problems presented by both spouses in terms of when they felt things were starting to become unglued. But let's see when things start to become unglued for all four types, except for the fourth type, the Abraham or Tevier type, which doesn't become unglued for them. The first is the area of interpersonal hostility, shown in frequent violent arguments, aggravated by practical problems, management of money, childbearing, the husband's attributing personal defects of some antisocial behavior, some lack of control. The wife in this stage is the one most likely to bring the complaints. Remember, this is just the first stage of the problem. The second sign is what is called interpersonal alienation. It shows in a lack of communication, a difference of aims and interests. You don't understand me anymore. I don't understand you. There's all kinds of intolerant behavior on both parts. There's quarreling. The wife feels lonely, increased by the husband's excessive drinking, possibly. That's the next factor. Third area is where there's a tremendous amount of coldness in the interpersonal relationship. The wife becomes indifferent, domineering, feels totally inadequate to handle the problems. Both feel as if they have a sexually cold partner. It's often accompanied with mental health disturbances. And it may go to very serious emotional instability on both parts of the marriage. Both of them become emotionally sick. The next, a different version of the power struggles appear. Here the wife is described as aggressive, domineering, nagging, distrustful, embroiled in her own little world. And the fifth area is where there is a desertion almost, an inability to solve anything. It's absolutely avoidance and apathy. There is no intimacy. It is characterized on the marital adjustment scale as the intimacy avoidance period. And, of course, the last is where the husband finally throws up the sponge. And he says, there's nothing I can do, and
In most cases, at least in traditional situations, the husband seeks the divorce and the wife is not terribly unhappy about his seeking it. Now, marriages go through these stages. And how can we get them to stop at stage one with just a little quarreling? Are there any ways in which I can envisage, or from my own experiences can counsel, about possibilities of working out something that we can do together? Something that the Janus type and the need achievement type, as I said, the first type is almost incurable. The fourth type doesn't need us. Let's see about what we can do to avoid the complete deterioration of the marriage. First of all, we want to point out that the important principle is what you can do together. One must be able to understand that the marriage depends upon the capacity of the people to do things together. I don't care whether it's drinking a martini or making a date to go to a museum or taking a weekend and going to a motel. The important principle is that they do it together. That they maintain a situation where the individuals feel that they are a team. They maintain their zest for living, I guess would be the best way to put it. Marriages that build emotional capital, that avoid those terrors that I have described earlier, are marriages in which the zest for living is constantly renewed. Like in literature, once a man proposed an affair to a young lady, and she said to him, "Is this your first?" And he said, "That's an embarrassing question. Suppose I would ask you the same thing." She said, "I would respond that it is my first." And he said, "Why?" She said, "Because I renew myself each time." So they renew their sense of excitement. Next, they solve problems mutually. They talk it over. Let's take a realistic situation. Should the wife go back to work at an earlier time, when the children are still very young? Should she start to work at an earlier time? Is this something that he should decide or she should decide? Wouldn't it be much more realistic if they both had the ability to solve the problem mutually?
But if I wait until Michael is in high school, well, that means I don't go back to work for another 4 years. And I really feel I want to be doing something. I'm capable, I'm educated. 4 years, that's such a long time.
Okay, well, let's think a moment. Basically, I agree with you, but maybe there's a partial solution. Right now, Michael gets home at about 3 p.m.
Right, and I like to be here when he gets home. He still needs supervision, and I wouldn't be here if I'm working.
But you would be here if you're working part-time. In the morning, that is.
That's true.
So you could do that. And in 4 years, or even earlier if you want, you could still move on to a full-time job.
That might be a good transition from not working at all over these years. Tell you the truth, I'm not sure I'm really ready to commit myself full-time.
And that's good thinking. You're coming up with the part-time idea.
Stop teasing now. You know it was your suggestion.
Okay. The next thing is to find that part-time job. Let's put our heads together and see if we can come up with some names and places.
This is something that should be worked out. Plan together. Work on it together. You take an approach where we have this concept of working it out. Next, you evaluate yourself on a regular basis. Marriages should be set upon the capacity of renewal of contracts. in a marriage, the wife and the husband should be able to discuss how well the marriage is going, how well they are doing, what are some of the areas where they can improve, where have they disappointed each other, where have they been less than they ideally thought was possible. The marriage is a marvelous vehicle by which one can do self-analysis. Next, you build emotional capital by accentuating the small things in life. It doesn't have to be a big event, an anniversary, Valentine's Day. It could be just a thoughtful thing like bringing home flowers or just getting up early in the morning to see a sunrise or at night to see a sunset. The capacity to observe the small things in life. Next, the ability to be open to mutual criticism. One has to be able to negatively evaluate the mate. I guess really the words that best describe the capacity to build emotional capital is flexibility, empathy, and motivation. Are you flexible? Or as somebody said, the taller the bamboo, the lower it can bend. Do you have empathy? What hurts the other person? Now somebody said, if you love me, you know what hurts me. And motivation. That is a desire to consider the family and the marriage as extremely important. You should also have the ability to dissolve roles. Too much of this macho destroys a marriage, this macho bit. You know, that's not a man's work. I notice my son, for example, prepares meals now. I never would do that. I think it's also necessary to reevaluate the corporate demands made upon the individual in honest, open discussions with the wife. Maybe the both of you decide that a new job or that a new challenge is not worth it. But you both decide you don't have a great desire to do this. You don't have a great desire to continue moving up the so-called economic ladder. I think it's necessary periodically to reevaluate the corporate demands made, but you do it mutually. You enjoy the present. You build emotional capital by enjoying the present. The mature personality and a mature marriage knows how to make the most of today. You don't live on an expectancy basis. You plan for the future, but you know that you must also live in the present. The mature personality and the mature marriage recognizes the best insurance for tomorrow is the effective use of today. Finally, we come to sex. Marriages do not break based upon sex alone. Sex is a sensitive barometer of problems in other areas. Good marriages have a playful attitude to sex. You know, they're like two puppy dogs playing in the grass. See, they realize that the major sexual organ of the human female is the cerebral cortex. It's how she sees a given situation. When a man comes home at night, unfortunately, he'd like to have an island isolated from the pressures of the world. She would like to have a peninsula, that she'd like to have him discuss what he's done during the day, to be connected to that part of his life. Having understood that, they both can so interface with each other that sex becomes a normal, flowing consequence of their emotional commitment to each other. So that sex is never just sex, but goes under many different masks. Now, while we are doing this together, while we are building emotional capital, because this inability to build emotional capital is what tears apart a marriage. The capital is something you draw upon in times of crisis. My father used to say to me that the blanket that hangs over the bed gives you the most warmth. It is the excess that you have in the bank that makes you feel better. The emotional capital is what you draw upon when a child is sick, when a child is caught smoking marijuana and the whole world seems to be falling down, when a child becomes mentally ill, when your mother dies, when she or you become ill physically, or when a child becomes emotionally ill. People say, see, the kid got killed in an automobile accident, and that's what destroyed the marriage.
That is not true. That is completely false. The marriage was destroyed because there was no emotional capital they could draw upon. There was none of the things I have described above. There was no doing it together. There was no problem-solving approach. There was limited empathy. They didn't have the excitement of living on a daily basis. You always have to have capital for emergencies, and capital is built on a daily basis. That, I believe, is a critical component of a successful marriage. I'd like to start this by reciting an incident in a session where I was asked to address a group of presidents and their wives, and it just so happens that in that same session was one of the secretaries of one of the presidents who was in attendance. And she said, I would like you to take a poll and find out how many wives here who are wives of executives who make over $20,000 a year, for example, how many of these women would like to have twice as much husband and half as much money?
Well, maybe not half as much, but I'd rather have more of him than more money.
I'll trade another promotion for just one night a week that he doesn't bring home work.
At some point, there has to be a decision that enough's enough.
The thing is that once you get caught up in success, you don't know how to stop it.
I'd not only get more husband, but the children would get more father.
Sure. I'd like twice as much husband. If he were in one place long enough for someone to introduce him to me. Huh, I think he's that tall fellow over there.
I guess twice as much husband and half as much money is the core of what we are dealing with in this cassette. Let me buttress this concept that the only way you're going to get more of your husband's time is to have him make less money. Here I'd like to turn to a massive AT&T study. This study, just completed by doctors Bray, Campbell, and Grant, was a monumental analysis of managerial progress at AT&T. The central concern of the AT&T Management Progress Study was to discover those factors that led to or hindered advancement of college graduate management trainees. The researchers had annual interviews for 8 years between the initial assessment of the individual, his reassessment at a later point. It covered all aspects of their experiences, such as family involvement, community activities, leisure pursuits. They were interested, these researchers, to find out which of the life themes changed as the men went up the management ladder, and which of the life themes changed for the successful versus the relatively unsuccessful management trainees. By analyzing the changing life themes of the successful versus the unsuccessful trainees, the authors posited two contrasting lifestyles. These contrasting lifestyles were called those of the enlarger and those of the enfolder. The enlargers were the ones who are most successful, and the enfolders the least successful. Now, I might point out these results are very similar to those that I have personally observed in my consulting work with other organizations. These results, I do not believe, just apply to a mammoth multinational organization such as AT&T. The enlarger lifestyle is oriented towards the goals of innovation, change, and growth. The enlarger moves away from tradition and places his emphasis on self-development, the extension of his influence outward into work and community spheres. The enlarger looks for responsibilities on the job and is likely also to seek and achieve a position of influence in organizations. Self-development and career development are those activities that are most stressed. At the same time, the earlier ties to parents and formal religious practices begin to weaken. The enfolder's lifestyle is oriented to the goals of tradition, stability, rather than pitching his influence outward. The enfolder seeks to cultivate and solidify that which invites attention within his own familial sphere. He forms close attachments to a small circle of friends, and most of his socializing is done with relatives. Status conditions, considerations sometimes embarrass him, and he values informality, sincerity, and genuineness in his human affairs. Thus we find that the more successful men become more work-oriented, more outward-oriented, away from the family, whereas the less successful men become more involved in their families, in their religious, recreational, and social activities. The enlargers are the Janices and the need-achievement people of the world. The enfolder is more like the Abrahams of the world. So is it possible, then, for these men who do move up in corporations, is it possible for them to develop some kind of meaningful family relationship? You know, I'm reminded of one author who said that the characteristics of a first-rate mind is the ability to hold two contradictory ideas in the mind simultaneously. A first-rate intelligence believes that it is all hopeless, but is determined to make it otherwise. Now, humbly, I would suggest that these recommendations are based upon the assumption that it may be hopeless, but we are determined in this cassette to make it otherwise. So I'm about to give you some recommendations which will hold for the wife, for the husband, and for the corporation. Let's paint a word picture of the person we're talking about. Let's say he is an enlarger. He's 34 years old. He's aggressive. He's ambitious. He's married. He loves his work. He spends 10 or 11 hours at work in the office. He comes home dead tired. He can be seen shuffling papers in his briefcase till after midnight. In short, he's a typical kind of executive family man. A need achiever on the way up. The only trouble is his wife. Here are 10 recommendations. I said I wouldn't give you 10, but I have changed my resolve because I think these are very important. These are my observations, which I think can be helpful towards achieving marital harmony for the busy executive. Put them aside. Use them for references. Try to keep them in front of you. One, stop hiding behind the alibis. They don't work, like you're doing all of this for the kids, or she's turning you into a garbage man. Stop hiding behind these rationalizations.
Do you think I work those hours because I like to? It's for the children. It's for you, for our future.
Do you really believe that?
Do you really believe I believe that? You know darn well you'd be pushing yourself whether you were married or not, kids or no kids.
So I'm selfish. I'm doing it for selfish reasons, huh?
Well, if you were doing it all for me, did you ever ask me whether I wanted you to do it for me? I don't remember ever being consulted about that or anything else.
But it's my career. You just aren't interested in it.
Well, I don't buy that. What did you ever do to bring me into your career? Let me share a little of it. Excuses, excuses. Can't you be honest with yourself for once?
Make certain that you avoid these fancy excuses. Your wife won't buy them. You've got to convince her you're ready to face the responsibilities of finding solutions to the problem. Sit down with your wife. Find out and decide what is really important. To schedule time for your family and regard it as therapy. Any good executive or businessman ought to be able to do this. Undivided time can be very therapeutic. If you can't spend evenings and weekends with your wife and children, try to get away with them from time to time. Every couple of months, take a week off. Dream together. My wife and I like to call this time the collecting of memories. Third, let yourself be interrupted during the business day by and for the family. One day, a young advertising executive was sitting in my office. We were in conference. My phone rang. It was his wife.
I thought I'd better get through to you, Jerry, and let you know it's really snowing hard up here.
Well, it doesn't look like much here in the city.
But you know the way it gets around home, icy and slippery.
Well, of course I know.
But don't you think you ought to leave the city early so you can drive slowly and carefully and beat the traffic out of the
city? My dear, I am neither a clock watcher nor a snow watcher.
The man happens to get along very well with his wife, so he can permit himself that occasional liberty. But a husband who's been neglecting his wife cannot afford to behave in that way. Fourth, if you travel and don't see your family for long periods, call home frequently. Use the telephone incessantly. Don't wait until you have a reason to call. Call your wife the first thing in the morning. Ask her how she slept last night, what book she's reading. Speak with the children before they leave for school. And don't talk in generalities. Talk to each youngster as an individual. Did you fix the washing machine for Mother? What dress are you wearing to school today? Call again in the evening around bedtime. Ask your wife about the PTA meeting, your boy about the ball game. Demonstrate to your family that you can still be very close to them while you are very far away. Five, set up ground rules by which you can work for the company part of the time and for the family part of the time. Two young executives I know have made compacts with their wives. One man goes to work early in the morning, stays at the office late, and frequently brings home work for more further analysis at night. Until recently, theirs was an unhappy marriage. But lately, he's given over his weekends entirely to his family. Starting Saturday morning, he doesn't breathe a word of business for 48 hours. He even gave up his weekend golf to be with his family. He does whatever the young children want to do. Boating, walking, movies, bowling. Saturday and Sunday night, he socializes with his wife and friends, or he or his wife take in a movie together. The other fellow is completely devoted to his family now, while the children are growing up. But he's agreed with his wife that once the youngsters finish high school, about 5 years hence, he's going to spend more and more time advancing his career. Soon she will see him less and less, except when they steal away together. His wife has accepted this, knowing that though he loves his work, he's sacrificing his advancement now for the children's sake. Six, don't be a gift horse with the children. Grandparents usually lavish gifts on children so there's rarely a need for the father to do the same. Seventh, share your experiences, your successes as well as your failures, as frequently as they occur. I knew a man who committed suicide. He just had it all bottled in. He could not communicate any sense of failure or frustration to his wife. Communicate. No wife can be enthusiastic about her husband's career if he never bothers to tell her about his business experiences. His wife often laments, "He never talks to me." The story goes that Tarzan came home from the jungle and he said, "Where's the martini?" And Jane said, "What's the matter? Why don't you talk to me? Why do you need a drink?" And Tarzan is reported as saying, "My God, Jane, don't you know there's a jungle out there?" One president of a university said to me, "I can't give a performance all day and come back at home and give one at night." He said, "I don't want to go through the traumas of the day. I want that island that I just discussed earlier." Well, unfortunately, you're going to have to develop a peninsula because she wants to be involved. Next, use your influence, position, and business skills to help your family. If your son needs copies of a map or geography class, ask your secretary to make copies. If your wife is writing a report for the PTA, have someone in your office type it up neatly and make copies for distribution. Your daughter needs to interview someone for a school project? Introduce her to one of your business associates. Begin to make small compromises. Acknowledge that some minor changes in your working habits will be necessary in order to pacify your wife. Major changes in your behavior are not necessary. You don't have to give up all business trips, all evening work, but it would be best if you could cut down the number of business trips you take. Send your assistant in your place occasionally. He may welcome the challenge. And try to make it home at a reasonable hour, at least 2 or 3 times a week. Avoid bringing home extra work unless you know that your wife is going to play canasta or going to play golf or do something else. If you need extra time in the office, go to work earlier in the morning. Few wives object to this. Small compromises like these are always possible. They are critical if you're to make a success of your marriage. Make meaningful use of your family time. If you are good at your work, then you're a good planner. Try to organize your time with your family and make it meaningful. Plan family activities just as you would your business activities. Set yourself up as the chairman of the entertainment committee. Most important, be involved. If you take your wife out to dinner, don't go to sleep. Stay awake, just as you would with a client. But later in life, you will discover that it's very important to have built and maintained a good relationship with your family. When a son was elected to the presidency, the late Joseph B. Kennedy said, "There is no other success for a father than to have made some contributions to the development of his children." And the elder Kennedy, as we all know, was frequently away from home for long periods of time. Remember, your wife is the key to your relationship with your children. She is the gatekeeper. Women have to play conflicting roles. And I know that you want credentials on your own. I know your problems. I know the difficulties, as I mentioned in earlier cassettes, about the challenges in those first periods of the marriage during the child-rearing times. However, I think there are things you can do. First of all, don't be afraid to complain about your husband. Studies by sociologists have demonstrated, after very diligent research, that a married woman is likely to spend hours on the phone discussing her husband's shortcomings. She might even mention it to his mother. Don't worry about complaining. Don't worry about ventilating. And the husband shouldn't worry about it either. At least you know she loves you enough to talk about you. Remember that there are times when he'd rather be with members of his own sex. When this occurs, it's important for the wife not to make him constantly feel guilty about it. Try to share experiences with him, but let him alone sometimes. Now, here are the ones who I think can be terribly destructive, and I have named them, and I'm sure that you may have seen these names before. There is Cora the clothes horse. She's dressed to kill. She makes the president's wife look like Ella Cinders. Then there's Fanny the flirt. She's always making a sexy suggestion at a cocktail party. Or there's Tipsy Tilly. Let's have another. You know, women becoming, unfortunately, very close to alcohol, and some of them becoming alcoholics. Unfortunately, this is part of the problem of the wife of an executive who's left alone too often. Then there is Ruthless Ruthie. Or Rivalous Ruthie, as some people call her. She's the Lady Macbeth of the executive arena, constantly pushing her husband to become the king. Next, don't be an armchair generalist. A wife should not chastise her husband with such statements as, "I told you so." Instead, she should help him absorb any failures by sharing some of the responsibility. She should let him know that her acceptance and love are based not on his material success, but on his human values. Next, encourage him to spend time with the children. But remember that most successful executives, the Janus type, the neat achievement type, has great trouble talking to children. Next, don't worry about arguments. They're going to continue. Well, your hope is that they'll be manageable. You know, most people, after 20 years of marriage, are often arguing about the same things they started arguing about during the first week of their marriage. Encourage your husband to take a vacation. Many men, you know, never do this without a push from their wives. It is valuable for a couple to vacation periodically within their means, and also from time to time to enjoy adult privacy away from the children. Even one day in the country, or an evening, can be beneficial. Be a good listener. Encourage him to share his emotional pressures. Let him be irritable, moody, tired, even angry. As I said earlier, a good marriage can take this in its stride. Don't cut him down when he's away. Especially, as we said, with the young children. Criticize constructively. Act as a spur, not as a stab. I think it is important to recognize that you are married to a man worthy of respect and affection. And by acting in a constructive way, you can serve his purposes. So what we have is the rules of the game for the husband, for the wife. Now let's look at the third part of this trinity, the corporation. I think the corporation has to get into this act. One, I think the corporation should make a clear policy statement. The organization should make it perfectly clear that they do not expect the individual to give everything of his libido and his energy to the company. If you do that, we'll run out of managers. Two, provide counseling. Alcoa and the Ford Company have a consulting psychiatrist on their staff. Third, nothing gives a wife more trouble than moving. When the corporation says we need you in Los Angeles, or Boston, or Albany, I think it's important that before a corporation move an individual, that they make certain they follow the following recommendations. Let all qualified people know of the move. Maybe there are some other people who want to go to Albany or want to go to Alberta, Canada. Assist in the sale of the home. Invite employees and spouse to the new community on your expense so they can see what living there would be like for them. Provide for the wife's transfer of credentials. I think it's important to provide for the wife's transfer of credentials. What I mean is that a wife is frequently the kind of person who has no credentials when she moves. Next, one executive who is now president of a very large company told me that when he was a young man and he was first asked to make a move, he came home and his wife went into a fit. She said the drapes wouldn't fit, the rugs wouldn't make it in the new home. She just painted the kitchen cabinets all by herself. All her sweat and toil went into this home. He then decided, based upon his own personal trauma, to make certain that whenever he asked an executive to move, he sent the wife a check for $500. He said to her, "Dear Jane, I know that your drapes won't fit, and I know that the rugs may not be exactly right, so here's $500, and in some cases he made it $1,000. Put it away, do what you want with it." Encourage the model of the successful marriage. Point out to all the people in your company that you don't have to be a monster to be successful. Maybe when a man is married 40 years, have a special company party. Point out to your people, you don't have to be a Janus. You don't have to be a monster. You can be a need achievement-oriented person and still be successful. Now, what about the future? What about future music? Who knows what the future is going to be? Maybe in the future this problem won't exist. There was a Wall Street Journal cartoon where a little child was in the desk drawer of an executive. And one fellow looked at him and said, "Don't you think you're carrying this women's lib thing a little too far?" Maybe that's what'll happen. Maybe we'll bring children to work. Maybe we'll bring them to the factory. Maybe men will work at home. Maybe we'll have women sharing jobs. Maybe you'll have a woman Monday, Wednesday, and another one Tuesday and Thursday. Who knows how it'll all turn out? At the moment, we have a problem, but maybe the future would solve itself. But the mills may grind so slowly that we may be dead of hunger before the flour is ready. So I hope these recommendations will be helpful as the mills grind. Maybe monsters will become dinosaurs.